Today on Off Mic, another African-American man is shot by police and more violence erupts. It's a recurring pattern in America. We speak to a native of Northwest Indiana, now living in Southeast Wisconsin, to get their take on the fallout. And all this civil unrest and the issues facing Black America is impacting sports. We talk to a veteran sports reporter to see why our athletes speaking up more. And we talk to a local Latino author on his book about a journey through Spain and his plans to write a memoir. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ Chicago. This past week has not been a good one for Kenosha, Wisconsin. On Sunday, a video made it to social media showing Kenosha police following 29-year-old Jacob Blake during an altercation. The video shows Blake walking around the front of the vehicle and opening the door to a minivan, which his kids were inside. A police officer opened fire on Blake, shooting him 7 times in the back. Blake survived, but violence erupted in the streets of Kenosha. Then on Wednesday, a 17-year-old from Illinois went to Kenosha and ended up shooting and killing 2 people and severely injuring another. Kenosha is now ground zero of places where police shootings of unarmed African Americans have led to civil disobedience. What's it like to live at Kenosha during this time? Joining me to talk about this is Broderick Smith, a native of East Chicago, Indiana, and truth be told, a longtime friend of mine. Broderick lives near Kenosha in Racine. Welcome to Off Mic, Broderick.
Hey, how's it going, Mike?
Good. So let me ask you this. So what's the situation now in Kenosha, Broderick?
It's disturbing, Mike. I think about how long this has been going on in our community, where we've always had this engagement with law enforcement, where law enforcement just has this look of young Black men or people of color as, you know, the enemy or as a threat to them. And, you know, that's so very far from the truth. And yes, I understand that we do have crime in some of our areas, in some of our urban areas, but not everyone is doing that. Not everyone is a gangster, or not everyone is out doing crime, robbing people. You have very productive citizens in our community. And one of the things that was very disturbing about that shooting is that, you know, in this area, Southeast Wisconsin, it's been going on for almost a year now, you know, where we've seen young Black men being gunned down. Here in Racine, we had a young man who they said had a weapon, but they shot him in the back as well. A Mount Pleasant police officer shot him in the back, Tyrese West. And then, you know, again, this that happened in Kenosha, where this young man is just walking to his car, they grab him by his shirt, and then you just hear gunshots, you know. So again, this thing of young Black men being a threat is so very far from the truth, but it's been happening for years in our community. So hopefully that, you know, that things will begin to change because of people standing up and saying this is wrong. And, you know, our politicians and the people, the leaders in our community get involved.
You know, this just shows an example as to how, you know, a moment in time can thrust a community into the bright lights of international news. So when you woke up or started hearing about this on Sunday, just like the rest of us, could you believe that this was happening in your own backyard?
I didn't believe it, but again, I guess we've been so accustomed to it in the last couple of months here, especially during the pandemic. We had the George Floyd situation. You know, we've had so many different looks at, you know, the way that police are dealing with, you know, young Black men. And it's again, very disturbing, but it's nothing new. And I think it's, and I hate to say that we're conditioned to what that process is or what's going on, But it's, again, it's been going on for years, because I even think about back to, you know, 1991, you know, what happened with the motorist in L.A. that got, you know, I can't think of his name right now, but he got, you know, pulled over and then was beaten half to death, and the, you know, the police got off, and then there was an uprising.
Rodney King.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Yeah. So again, it's been going on for years, and again, I you know, the only thing that's going to change this is, you know, us changing the system. The system has to change, you know, and engaging, you know, citizens, and not thinking of everyone as a threat. And I understand, you know, being in the military, we have rules of engagement as well. But, you know, again, the police engagement with citizens, I mean, when you, it just baffles me how they think sometimes. So.
Now, Broderick, you and I grew up in the same community, East Chicago, very diverse, blue collar. We went to high school together, actually graduated the same year, 1986, from East Chicago, Washington. Tell us about your life since graduating high school. I understand, I think you joined the military, and how did you make it up to live in Racine?
Yeah. I joined the military, but in 86, I went off to basic training at in South Carolina, Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I was in the U.S. Army. And then after that, I did my AIT, which is our schooling. I did that in Augusta, Georgia, which is Fort Gordon. And then after that, I did a tour in Germany, over in Europe. I also did a tour in California, Fort Ord, California, and I did a tour in Panama. And then after that, I decided to, you know, leave the military. But after I got up by Chicago in the suburbs, Waukegan, I moved there. And then I moved to the city next to it, North Chicago. And I started working there, started doing jobs there. And then in the year 2000, I moved to Wisconsin, my wife and I, because we were doing, you know, ministry with the church and stuff like that. And then, you know, we opened up our salon and our business in 2006. And then, you know, that's pretty much how I got here. So, but this is, when I got here, this community was a very, very inviting, and you know, and I guess the economics part to, you know, start to play a part. And, you know, we had Republican, not to be political, but we had Republican governors at the time that, it didn't really pour into the black communities like they should have. And, you know, it's kind of been that way, you know, ever since. So, but hopefully, you know, again, things will change.
Yeah. And, what, you know, you live right outside, you live in Racine, Kenosha's, just a little bit of south of you, I believe. I'm trying to look
right.
at, yeah. Right. And so what have you had a chance to go into Kenosha and sort of assess what's been going on there? Or do you have friends who actually live in Kenosha?
Yes, I do. But no, I haven't been there yet. I haven't been to Kenosha yet since everything started. I will be down there in September, because I got one more class at school that I got to take. So, but pretty much, from the emails and stuff that I'm getting from the university and stuff, is that, that, you know, they're locking down the campus, and, you know, that from the videos that I've seen on TV or on Facebook, you know, they got barricades up down on Sheridan Road, you know, where people can't go into the downtown area, because that's where a lot of the protest and a lot of the looting and violence and burning has been taking place. So, but I haven't really got down there to see it for myself yet. So, but I plan on being down there next month. So,
well, Broderick, you've seen some of the unrest that has ensued in Kenosha, you know, following the shooting. Let me ask you this: do you feel that? I mean, some people say it's not justified. It is justified. That yes, it's a tragic shooting to what happened, but the violence is not justified. Where do you stand on that? Because some people say, Also, well, it is justified considering you see that this is just another example of an unarmed black man getting killed by police officers, and something has to give. How's your view on that?
My view is this: you know, when people get angry, when you get angry, you're not thinking rationally. You know, anger, there's no rationale in anger. And some people, I think about my wife and how she said when she gets angry, when she gets so angry, she blacks out and she doesn't remember anything. And that, I think that's the thing when you get angry about something. And that's what you have out there, a lot of angry people that, you know, and some of these people even witnessed what happened. Well, a lot of people witnessed what happened through the video, but some people were there and they're out, you know, protesting and out, you know, saying what needs to be said. And yes, it's, you know, again, everybody wants to know all the facts and what happened and what led up to this, because all you see on the video is, you know, them going after him, pointing guns at him, going after him. And then, you know, they pull him by his shirt, and then the shots go off. So my thing about it is, I personally, and this is just my personal thought on it, I thought it was excessive. I mean, because you had, again, you had at least four policemen around this young man. They could have tackled him. They could have did something different. You know, they could have did something a lot different before, you know, pulling the trigger on this man. You know, and to me, it wasn't justified. I think that was just overdoing. That was overkill. A lot of people are going to say things different. I've seen a lot of different posts. I've seen a lot of different opinions from people, you know, but that doesn't take away, you know, what happened to this young man. He got shot in his back 7 times. And he's paralyzed for the rest of his life. You know, we don't have to live with that. He does. You know, so, and I know his loved ones, they're again, anger. And, you know, this is what happens. You know, people get angry and they want to say something. But when they do try to say something, they feel like they're not heard. So, again, they act out to be heard. So, and I think that's what's happening. People are not acting out to be heard. So that's what's happening with it right now. But whether it's justified or unjustified to some people, me personally, I say it wasn't justified.
Well, yeah, I'm not a police officer, but at the same time, I did see the video like you did. I'm wondering, okay, as he's walking away from him with his back to him, why doesn't he just tackle him? Him there, or other officers go around the minivan, and because there was kids in that minivan, his kids were in there. Why didn't they just then shoot him with with weapons that are non-lethal weapons, you know, beanbags or something to knock him to his knees or something to get control? I mean, 7 shots to his back. Yeah, you're right, and then with the end result of the unrest, you know, 2 other people have been killed and another one seriously injured when another individual decided to take it upon himself to drive to Wisconsin to act as some mini cop and shot 2 people and killed them, and 17 years old. So a lot of unfortunate to go around in Wisconsin. Let me ask you this. Does it help being from a sort of a community like East Chicago and then going up to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and just seeing, well, you're in Racine. I mean, is it as diverse as East Chicago? Is it, does that background help you in any way?
Oh, yeah. The background from East Chicago definitely helps. Plus, again, I've traveled around the world, so I've been in a lot of diverse places, you know, around this country as well as outside of the country. So I have a different outlook, you know, on diversity, you know, especially, you know, being in the military, you had to take care of one another, you know, whether you're white or black or Mexican or Puerto Rican. I mean, it doesn't matter what race you are. You know, we took care of each other in the military. And, you know, again, that's being from East Chicago, did that same thing, you know, because I looked at it as, you know, man, you know, the melting pot that we have, we, you know, I think that all people would get along like that, but it wasn't so, you know.
It's got to hurt as a African-American as yourself that the first sort of, you know, line of defense for a police officer is always a fatal line, that there isn't anything below that. It's always kill the suspect in front of you. And the stark example is the 17-year-old white kid from Illinois going up there, shooting three people, and he didn't get shot. He's taken into custody, but he didn't get shot by police. I mean, that's a stark example of what a lot of people are saying is just that's the difference between being African American in this country and being white.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the biggest difference. And you know, they didn't even reveal his name either. If that would have been somebody of African American descent, they would have put their name, posted their face all over the media and everything, man. And so, again, it's the media has a big part to play in this as well, because again, they're pushing that you know, our young black men are threats to the whole society, and it's not true, man. It's sad that we have to go through this, but you know, again, we have to change the infrastructure. We have to change it from the inside, and it'll go out.
Well, Broderick Smith is a native of East Chicago, Indiana, and is now living in Southeast Wisconsin. Broderick, thank you so much for being here and talking with us on Off Mic.
I appreciate it, Mike. Appreciate being on the show, man.
All right. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Tom Lounges has been a region radio personality and a music journalist since 1979. Lounges has earned special recognition awards for his work in the entertainment field and has rubbed elbows with the virtual who's who of major entertainment figures. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on your favorite artists and your favorite artists you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Tuesday at 7 and every Friday at 1 o'clock right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage.
We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing. So we got we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Can't make the big game? Or maybe you're at the big game and you want to know about the other big game. Lakeshore Game Night will take you to every game tonight starting at 6 p.m. Join Tommy Williams, Wayne Svetnoff, and their team of correspondents to get the latest scores and updates from the Doonland, Greater South Shore, Great Lakes, and Northwest Crossroads Conferences. It's Game Night tonight at 6 here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. It's time for a new segment called Local Authors, where we highlight, well, local authors. Many of us have chased after a lost love. So did Miguel, who traveled to northern Spain to find Beatrice. But in his journey, Miguel finds another love. That's the story behind the book, Lost and Found on the Camino de Santiago. It's written by Juan Carlos Hernandez of East Chicago. Juan joins us to talk about the book and his plans for more writing. Juan Carlos, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi.
Can you hear?
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, I can hear you.
great. Juan, before we get into talking about your book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I do know you grew up in East Chicago. What else have you done?
Wow. Well, yeah, I grew up here, went through the public schools here, graduated, went to IUN, and did a degree in education. But a seed was sown for writing and storytelling back when I was in, well, probably a kid, but it really just flowered when I was in college. I met a great professor, Dr. Ima Menoves-Myers. She was a professor of Spanish there and encouraged me to write, and that little seed that she sowed never left me. So I decided to pursue writing or storytelling more thoroughly. So I moved to Mexico for a couple years, and I worked as a reporter down there for an English language newspaper down in Guadalajara. And then came back to Northwestern and did a master's in journalism. Journalism is great training for great storytelling. It really forces you to be very selective with your words and keep your writing tight. That's what really motivated me. And then after I went to Northwestern, you know, journalism has changed so much. There wasn't much of a market for journalists, but I kept writing. I knew that I could never leave that. So I wrote this book after I actually did my pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Some of it is based on those experiences. Other things are made up. That's for me to know and the reader just to wonder.
That's right. That's right. So this isn't a book where in your mind that, you know, you just made up, you actually traveled to Spain to get the inspiration to do this story.
Yeah. Though that was not on my mind when I did that pilgrimage. It was something I wanted to do. I was finishing the master's degree at Northwestern. I had a lot of things on my mind and heart. I was in the Czech Republic at the time and just wanted to get away before I came back to this side of the Atlantic. So I did a month of walking and thinking and praying and lots of things in northern Spain. Yeah, it wasn't on my mind. But when I came back, it was something inside me that just I had to get out, so I started writing.
And you said some of the experience in northern Spain on your journey inspired the story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the synopsis for your book?
Well, some of it obviously is based on what I've lived, but it's so the main character's name is Miguel. He suffers heartbreak letting go of a girl, and he's still dealing with that heartbreak when he's starts this pilgrimage, trying to heal from that, trying to figure out how to go forward and not just remain in that place. So he starts this pilgrimage, and along the way, I mean, what I saw is in my pilgrimage is just incredible beauty of the landscape in northern Spain through all these hilly regions and medieval towns. That was really, really beautiful to step into places where pilgrims had stepped for over 1,000 years. And seeing that and knowing that, it was really moving. But what was most moving beyond that was the solidarity between human beings. Now, this route is along an one of the oldest Christian pilgrimages. It's very Catholic. The thing about the Camino, it's open to everyone. You don't have to be particularly, you know, religious or a person of faith, but it is certainly spiritual, and I think that awakens a profound sense of connection and solidarity between pilgrims, especially pilgrims doing the walk you know, on foot, because you can do it on a horse, you can do it on horseback, you can do it on a bike. Some people do it with the support of a car or a bus, but the best way to do it is to do it on foot. And it's that solidarity between people that just really is moving, especially given the circumstances we're living through now. I always go back to that time in Spain and think about how human beings loved and supported each other on this way. And it really gives me hope for humanity. And that's what I try to communicate through the book.
So how long was the entire pilgrimage? A couple of months, couple of years?
Wow. I wish I could have taken a couple of months. No, I took about a month between preparation. It was about a month and 2 weeks. Like I said, I was in the Czech Republic, and fortunately I had been, you know, walking everywhere around Europe at that time. So I was in pretty good shape. I had lost about 20 pounds.
Wow.
Between my departure here from O'Hare to Europe, to when I started the Camino, I was 20 pounds lighter. I was a lot stronger and more fit. So, and then I bought some things, and I just started searching the internet for information on the Camino. And then I left in June of 2006, last day of May, or I think the first day of June, I can't recall, when I landed in Spain. And I started the Camino a few days later. And it took me a month, and that was doing it at a pretty good pace. You have to really, I think if you want to do the Camino, you should take about a month, month and a half. I know that's really hard for people here in the U.S. to get time off for that, but I think if anybody wanted to do it, that would be the good way to do it, or the right way to do it. In Europe,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, did the characters in your story, were they developed while you were on the journey, or that they sort of, were they born once you came back and started the writing, the thought process on that?
Some of them were inspired by people I met, honestly. And they came to life here on the page. Like I said, I had no plans whatsoever to write a book about the Camino or about something based on my own experience in that sense. There was no plan for that. But I came back, started writing about a month after I got home, and I kept writing and writing and writing, and fortunately was able to finish the book.
Let me ask you this. What is your process for writing? Because I know a lot of young or probably older people listening to this program who are thinking, you know, I have an idea for a book, but I just don't know how to get started. I'm not a writer. I'm not a reporter and things like that. What was your process in taking, you know, for me, I mean, it would take me a long time to write a book just because I need the perfect writing conditions away from Marvel movies and sports and my kids, and just need to concentrate on this. And I rarely have gotten that time. So what was it like for you to get down and do this writing?
Well, it is a challenge. You know, even, you know, I'm single, you know, I've been in, you know, a couple relationships, and sometimes they've been distractions, and I have chores and stuff to take care of here at my home and work. I, you know, have to earn a living. That said, you know, my process is, you know, sitting down to do it. I really do enjoy the time away where you're just, or the time where you can be on your own and just concentrating on reading and writing and you know, revising. But the best thing to do is, even if you have to get up at the crack of dawn when everybody's asleep, and writing for an hour. If it's, you write 500 words, 300 words, 1,000 words in that hour, at least you got something done. That's one of my favorite writers. I don't know if I'm quoting her or somebody she quoted, Anne Lamott. She said the best inspiration for writing is putting your butt on a chair and getting to work. So yeah, I believe me, I totally get what you say about needing that space. And it is, I've had that space a few times in my life, but it's dealing with the challenge of just sitting down to do it as much as you can every day or every other day or three times a week or once a week. Sometimes it's tough to find the time.
Juan Carlos, let me ask you this. Your experience in growing up in East Chicago, I grew up in East Chicago, and I find it, and I'm not just saying this, I find it a very unique city in Indiana, in the Chicagoland area, unlike a lot of parts of Indiana, which do not, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Sorry. That, you know, there's a lot of cities in Indiana that do not like look like East Chicago. Does your experience, does your background growing up in East Chicago, did it help you in writing this book?
Yeah, I would say it was growing up in East Chicago. I say this, I grew up in East Chicago and I grew up in Michoacan in Mexico. Those two places, the town where I was born in Mexico, I was raised here in the United States, but I was born in Mexico. Those two places influenced so much of who I am and what I think about, how I process the world, that yes, here in East Chicago, yeah, going to church, talking to neighbors, being with family. I mean, folks here, I mean, we're, I think, simple working folks. That's not to diminish who we are. It's just who we are. And it says a lot. My parents were committed to helping raise a family and seeing their sacrifice, their work every day, their faith, going to church, their service, helping neighbors, their love for us, their love for each other. That really shaped the way I see the world and their stories, especially my mom's story. She was a great storyteller, sometimes an exaggerator. But that's part
aren't
of
all
the,
moms like that.
Yeah, that's part of the storytelling. You know, she was great at that. But also my tío Roberto, he came here to South Chicago specifically because South Chicago also had a huge influence on me. He came to South Chicago back in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up here. He was in the military here. But he shared a lot of experiences about growing up during the Depression here, about serving in the military and dealing with racism, even though he was serving his country. And dealing with a lot of things of just growing up Mexican in South Chicago. He had this sense of love for his people, but also this a little, I could always sense it, and my mom would even tell him sometimes, a little bit of shame of what he went through or how he experienced discrimination. I saw that in him, but I still saw this incredible love for family, and he was a great storyteller too. He was loud, he was obnoxious sometimes, he enjoyed food, and that's a big part of who I am. I love to cook. I grew up with my mom and my family cooking in the kitchen.
Sure.
So that all of that influenced me in who I am.
Well, my grandmother was from Urapan, Michoacan, and so I'm wondering, where was your mother from?
Oh, my mom, wow. Well, I was born, my mom is from Siracuaretiro, Michoacan, which is about 20 minutes from Uruapan, and I was born in Tingamato, Michoacan, which is about 20 minutes from Uruapan. Equidistant, although different places.
Sure.
Yeah, that influenced me. My mom didn't grow up cooking with her mom. She cooked with her grandmother. Her grandmother was more of the cook.
Right.
And she learned a lot more about cooking from her mother-in-law, my dad's mom.
Well, Juan Carlos, I know you were talking about, do you have any plans for writing more books?
Yeah. I'm working on two books right now. I'm working on a memoir. It's going to be straight memoir. I'm not fictionalizing anything, although, you know, people may have processed it differently from my own experience. It's called Bittersweet, Agridulce, and it's about stories about family, faith, and growing up in the kitchen, you know, and beyond the kitchen too, obviously. But it's also reflecting on, you know, losing my parents in the last 3 years and you know, just that time of dealing with those losses. That's the main thing. Last year I just wrote stuff in my notebooks. I mean, I was just writing and writing and ranting sometimes. Now I'm processing a lot of it and putting it into digital form on my computer. I'm also wrote, and I'm still going to change it a few things. I'm writing a children's book called New Year's Dog, and that's about one of my dogs. I inherited two from my father, but I had a dog, and we found her on New Year's Day in Guadalajara, And just how special that little pooch has been in my life, and I think how they are in a lot of people's lives. So I got that out to a publisher, and they didn't accept the manuscript, but that's part of this work. So I'm going to go and make some, touch it up a bit and send it out again. And I really think people will like that book. It's a children's book, but I think a lot of people will identify with it. So that's what I'm working on right now. And actually, one more thing, a book of poetry. That was actually the first book I ever published. It was for my parents only. But now I've gone back and I've been revising the poetry.
Well, Carlos, let me ask you this. So many of our black brothers and sisters out there are going through a lot. There's a lot of unrest. There's a lot of anger in this time. Do you see your writing being influenced at that at all? But how are these experiences now influencing you as a writer?
You know, I've been reflecting on that a lot. I haven't written anything or any essays, but I was thinking about that a few days ago, like, that I think right now for a lot of us, whatever background, you know, whoever we are, I think we need to listen and certainly engage in conversation with our black brothers and sisters. But I think the first step is listening, because I don't want to write about something that I've never experienced. I'm not black. That doesn't mean I can't identify with racism. I can't identify with the difficulties that, you know, growing up not white in predominantly white society, where there is such a thing as white privilege. There just is, and it's not fake. You know, those things I can identify with. But as I'm not a black person, so I want to listen and perhaps digest some of that, and then say in solidarity, like if I did happen to write something, I'm here to listen and engage with you on the work of justice as your brother. But I can't be, I don't think I can try to offer a remedy without listening first.
I got to say, I've known Juan Carlos Hernandez now for several years, and I find him to be one of the most talented writer journalists in the Chicago area. So if you don't know him, try to follow him, try to look him up on Facebook. Very good looking guy, kind of curlyish hair, a little tall. I'm pretty sure he is Miguel in the book. I don't know. I don't know that for sure. I'm just speculating. But at the same time, Juan Carlos is immensely, immensely very just talented. I'm just blown away, and I feel so proud to call you friend, and also, a person who also grew up in the same town that I did. So, Juan Carlos, where can we find your book, Lost and Found on the Camino de Santiago?
Well, that you can find it on Amazon. You could just look up the name of the book, and that's where you find it. Or you can follow me on Instagram, Juan Carlos Hernandez. And if you wanted a signed copy, a signed hardcover, I do have some of those. I could, you know, make it available that way. But if you just want a soft cover book just to read it, it's available on Amazon.
Once this pandemic lifts, maybe we'll just do a festival of local authors that I've interviewed from Northwest Indiana, Chicagoland area. Juan Carlos Hernandez, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
No, well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage.
We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing. So we got, we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
can't make the big game, or maybe you're at the big game and you want to know about the other big game. Lakeshore Game Night will take you to every game tonight starting at 6 p.m. Join Tommy Williams, Wayne Svetnoff, and their team of correspondents to get the latest scores and updates from the Doonland, Greater South Shore, Great Lakes, and Northwest Crossroads Conferences. It's Game Night tonight at 6 here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Tom Lounges has been a Region radio personality and a music journalist since 1979. Lounges has earned special recognition awards for his work in the entertainment field and has rubbed elbows with the virtual who's who of major entertainment figures. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on your favorite artists and your favorite artists you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Tuesday at 7 and every Friday at 1 o'clock right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ Chicago. Professional sports in the United States just restarted a month ago after months off due to the pandemic. They're back to playing with both the White Sox and the Cubs, giving us already some very exciting moments. The playoffs are happening in both the NBA and NHL, and the NFL is looking to start up training camp. But the games have come to a halt due to the shooting of James Blake in Kenosha. The social unrest due to Black Americans being killed or injured by police is causing some professional athletes to put playing on the back burner. And joining us to talk about the latest is veteran Chicago sports reporter Cheryl Ray Stout of WBEZ in Chicago. Hello, Cheryl. How are you?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm fantastic. Well, you know, 2020 just continues to be both amazing and disappointing. Just earlier this week, Lucas Giolito of the Chicago White Sox pitched his first no-hitter. Very exciting. Just on cloud nine from, of course, he did it, you know, before an empty stadium. But later this week, I think yesterday, he spoke about the unrest and players deciding not to play games. That's a huge contrast. And it shows while a no-hitter is great, there are bigger issues in society right now. Tell us what's been going on.
Well, Lucas did speak to us. In fact, here's the interesting part. It was an off day for the White Sox. He wanted to talk to the media. And I led off the conversation with him about what he felt about what was going on in the league. And he was very emphatic how important it was. This isn't new to him. He actually started to really become conscious about what was going on, especially during the George Floyd killing. And, you know, he's been getting involved with social issues. He's involved with Sam Acho's work on the west side of Chicago. So this is a young man that's seizing the moment, understanding he has a platform, and wanting to get out what he feels is the bad problems that's dealing with social justice. So you had him. And the interesting thing, the White Sox last played on Wednesday, and they had yesterday off. So they didn't have a stoppage, per se, of their games. But they were in tune with what was going on. We had the NBA started it with the Milwaukee Bucks because they are in close proximity to Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm very familiar with Kenosha because my son went to college there. And the thing is, one of the players that made the statement was Sterling Brown. And Sterling Brown is from Maywood, Illinois, and he is suing the Milwaukee Police Department because they used excessive force on him with a parking violation. So you had that brewing with them, and they walked out. The WNBA, I was on the phone call with James Wade, their head coach, and their general manager. And, you know, we talked about what was going on, and then eventually the WNBA, they went, they called up their games for a couple of nights. They are resuming action tonight. So there's a lot of things going on. I was at Hallis Hall yesterday with the Bears. They had a 9:20 practice. I got up there at 8:15 like we're supposed to, and they canceled their practice, and we had to leave the facility. So there's a lot of thinking and using their platform to bring focus to what is going on, especially what happened just recent events.
You know, Cheryl, I've been watching sports all my life now, and usually sports is sort of that escape from whatever is happening in your everyday life, whatever turmoil is happening in the streets, you didn't really see that filtering into the basketball court, baseball field, football field. But I haven't been covering or seeing it as long as you have. Have you ever seen a time where whatever is happening in society, politics, social unrest, has filtered into the ball fields?
I've seen it with the Olympics in 68. I've seen it in the various spots. I saw it with Muhammad Ali. But the moment recently was 4 years ago when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, and everything he dealt with from either side of his view, that was the moment that has sparked everything that's happened in sports now. That's when he did that at a time where other players didn't feel comfortable because the NFL does not have solid salaries. They could be cut at any time. And so they were always afraid to risk that. But what happened because of the pandemic, we got to say because of the pandemic and things were shut down, and then you had the George Floyd thing happen, his murder happen, that allowed teams and players to reassess how they viewed social justice.
And let's look at who these athletes are. They are multimillionaires in most cases. They can afford perhaps take a few days off or a week off without getting paid. They're doing what probably a lot of hourly workers wish they could do. Say, mm-hmm. You know what? I'm not coming into work because I'm pissed off of what everything is going on, and I want to express that. I want to go protest. I can't do that. I work hourly. They're doing things. They're actually giving voice to blue collar workers who may feel frustrated that they can't be out there. These people, these athletes, have the means and the voice and the platform to do that.
And they're not just using their voices, they're using their influence and their money. In fact, what happened in with the Milwaukee Bucks down in Orlando is they got on the phone before they did their walkout. They got on the phone with the officials in Wisconsin to talk to them saying, look, we want public pressure to be put on the legislature to get action done. So they're not just, you know, taking a day off. They are using that to employ politicians, legislatures, people of power to help them. And they want their owners to help too. So it's going to be interesting what happens beyond today. And it allowed everyone's talking about it that they wouldn't before.
You know, Cheryl, I'm just thinking as you as a sports reporter, and I mean this playfully in that you're a great sports reporter, but has there ever been a time in your sports reporting journey that you've had to become more than just a sports reporter? You're talking about social justice issue, business issues, so many things this year that has happened because of the pandemic and social unrest that you are much more than just a sports reporter right now.
Well, you know what people don't understand, when you are a sports reporter, you actually have to have so many tentacles. You have to know the law. You have to know medical terms. This is another avenue. I've always been somebody that's been very much in my mind, in my thoughts, in my words about social justice. So it actually makes me feel good that something is happening now. It may sound strange, but I'm so glad that people are using their voices and being able to do this. And to be honest, Michael, I'm exhausted. I'm working around the clock because things don't just, you know, sports does not end between nine, you know, it doesn't go between 9 to 5. It happens around the clock and through the weekend. So I am constantly, you know, being informed, trying to find out information and making sure that I have the up-to-date information on everything. And it's exhausting.
Oh, Cheryl, and we are always so grateful that you're on with us because, folks, if you're not familiar with Cheryl Raystout, she is a very wanted quantity. There are times where she joins us after having been on the BBC or NPR on the national network. She's on TV. She's on radio. She's very sought after. Of course, you can hear a lot on WBEZ, and I'm not wrapping this up, so this doesn't think I'm wrapping it up, but I just wanted to get that out there, that we're always very grateful to have your expertise here on our show, on our little show here on Lakeshore Public Radio. But let me ask you this. There's a flip side to a lot of this discussion of the social justice, and a lot of a few Chicago athletes have gotten in the crosshairs by what they posted or said, and they've gotten onto Twitter. Mike Ditka has been one recently who have kind of talked about if you want to kneel for the national anthem, you should get out of the country. Brian Urlacher this week, he kind of alluded that he wasn't in support of not having these games. They can get in the crosshairs with that. Do you know if Brian Urlacher's comments or his statements on Twitter have angered some of his former teammates?
Yes.
They have?
Yes. Matt Forte, if you go on Twitter, read what he wrote. It was very impassioned. It was retweeted by Lance Briggs, who worked alongside of Brian Urlacher. The Bears had to release a statement last night saying that they, you know, they don't agree with what, you know, Brian Urlacher is saying. The thing is Brian is so far removed from the team, he doesn't know that they have been having meetings about this. They shut down practice yesterday, and they had meetings for hours about this. They've had meetings during the George Floyd situation. So they've been talking about this for a while, and Brian Urlacher is tone deaf to that. Now, he has the right to say and think anything he wants, but if you are a public figure and you say that, you're going to have to expect to get pushback, and that's what's happening with his and the players on the team now. I would imagine, and I don't know this for a fact, but I imagine Brian Urlacher will not be welcomed at Hallis Hall.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. He was a fan favorite. I have his jersey, and now it might be a political statement just to wear his jersey now, but there is fallout no matter which side of the discussion you're in. And I don't know how close these players were when they were playing, but it does seem like, you know, some friendships may end with him. And he was a, you know, critical part of the Chicago Bears in the Super Bowl back in 2006 when they last played. But this is a very heated time where people can say what, you know, they write on Twitter, not knowing the impact those statements might have.
That's always been my, you hit it on the head, because it's social media, and they don't understand that when you are just media, you have a standard. You have to understand what will affect people and how it could affect people. And the problem with players, they're putting things out there, not realizing that everybody can see it. And if you're going to do that, expect you're going to have people disagreeing with you. And they're going to disagree with you very vehemently, especially because of the times.
Let me ask you this. I had always thought maybe the pandemic may be the entity to delay or just postpone some of these seasons. Now it looks like maybe social unrest and just not having the, I don't know, impetus to want to have to finish it. What do you see? And we only got about a minute left. So do you just see maybe everything that's going on in the country may be dooming the seasons not to go on?
No, I understand that the NBA will be going back. The WNBA is going back today. The NHL is going back tomorrow. And MLB right now is making plans to have their World Series and playoffs in certain locations. So it's going to the seasons will continue.
Well, Cheryl Ray Stout is a veteran sports reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. You can Google her name. She is one of the best sports writers out there. And I just got to thank her so much for joining us here on Off Mic. Cheryl, get some rest, and thank you so much again for joining us here on Off Mic.
Anytime, Michael, anytime.
Well, that is our show for today. I got to thank my staff here on Lakeshore Public Radio, Jose Rodriguez, Dee Dotson, Chris Nolte, Tom Maloney, all the great people here. You can hear this show again as a podcast on lakeshorepublicradio.org. Thank you for listening. Have a nice weekend. I'm Michael Puente. Stay safe.